Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan is not here. She's back on Monday. Andrew Cabral is kindly sitting in. I am Jim Browdy. We're live at the library, streaming at youtube.com/CBH News. Mayor Wu will join us for an hour of Ask the Mayor at the library on Tuesday. And in 40 minutes, the Culture Show will be here live as well. If you're here, stick around. If you're not, you might want to come on by. We're joined now on Zoom by food policy analyst, multiple James Beard winner, Corby Kummer. Corby's the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, senior editor at the Atlantic, and senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Hello, Corby Kummer.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Andrea.
Hi, hey there. How are you? Corby, you know, this sort of surprised me in a way. Tell us a little bit about the Olympic Committee sort of dipping its toe into the water of sponsorship. I mean, and the reason I say this surprises me is because I've always sort of thought of the Olympics as keeping the money end separate from the athletic end, even though I know the two are connected. So tell us what the Olympic Committee is doing with regard to Big Soda.
I don't think there's anything new about the Olympic Committee soliciting sponsorships to defray the unbelievable cost of any city. You know, Boston, I think, has breathed a big sigh of relief that it didn't get chosen. London spent $17 billion, and Paris has tried to keep it to $6 or $7 billion, but it was a billion more than they thought. So Olympic Committee, everybody costs lots of money. Sponsorship, sports sponsorships, they've been big for decades. Coca-Cola has been very big, for example, in public schools in sponsoring sports. And they've sponsored the Olympics for at least two or three cycles and probably more. The article I think we both saw didn't specify how many. But there was a new Kick Big Soda Out of Sports campaign done by Vital Strategies. And I know Vital Strategies is a really great, excellent, global, somewhat wonky policy, health policy organization. They've come out big and strong against plastic pollution, carbon emissions, water depletion, but most of all health, and most of all marketing sugary beverages to children.
You know, one of the things I loved in this story was they talk about athletes themselves taking a stand. They have Ronaldo, the great soccer player at Euro 2020. When he's doing a press conference, they plop two bottles of Coke in front of him, and he deliberately moves them to the side so they're not in the shot. So it's pretty great. And I'm assuming these athletes who are at the pinnacle of health find it as objectionable as someone like you does, Corby Kummer.
I think it depends on the athlete. Presumably they do, but you know, it's irresistible to read stories about major sports teams and leagues having different dietitians and nutritionists. And yes, there's a lot of healthful food, but there's a lot of selective junk food. And it doesn't matter. Athletes are burning so many calories, they can do whatever they want. But bad habits are bad habits, and they last after athletic exertion. So it's just bad to be drinking sugary beverages regularly.
I want to retract what I just said, because I just realized I drive by the McDonald's on Soldier Field Road, where Olympian Jason Tatum, after the Celtics won the championship, had a sign that said, "Congratulations to our customer, Jason Tatum." So he's obviously a McDonald's kind of guy.
No, I mean, I don't think that the fact that it might not be good generally stops people from...
Doesn't stop me.
And we may have occasion to speak about that.
We may, a little bit later in the show. That's true.
But, Corby, what I'm thinking is that there is a bit of a slippery slope argument about this. I mean, to be clear, the Olympic Committee was urged to end the Big Soda, the Coca-Cola sponsorship. There's no indication that they have actually done it. But wouldn't you think that they would be concerned that there may be legitimate reasons for sort of disdaining the sponsorships of things, companies that make products that are sugary or bad for you, but that also is a slippery slope. It easily leads into disdaining sponsorships for companies that just do things we don't like.
This is the problem. Well, let's stick to food. When you're trying to compare food to tobacco, and this campaign we've been talking about says, remember, when we kick tobacco out of big sports. Tobacco is a poison. It kills. There's no controversy at all. Soda manufacturers can make the argument that it's all dose dependent, that it's not necessarily addictive. There are different definitions of addictive. Yes, it is a slippery slope when it comes to food. As far as one company manufacturing munitions that are going to Russia to fight Ukraine through some other branch. That does get to a slippery slope, but it depends on the press and customers exposing it. With the IOC, it would have to be enough sports leagues, enough countries that join the Olympics and pay the colossal fees to join the Olympics protesting a certain product and sponsorship to get it booted out. And I don't see that happening.
I want to make sure we agree, though, that while I think all three of us say it'd be better if Coke wasn't the sponsor, do we all agree that if you're an Italian gymnast by the name of Giorgia Villa, it is fine to have your sponsor be wheels of Parmesan cheese? Oh, there she is.
Yeah.
There is the Italian gymnast.
That's not AI.
With a, oh, look at her doing a tumble over some Parmesan cheese. Are you okay with that, Corby? How great a photo is that?
Parmesan is the king of cheese, and everyone should have it in their refrigerator at all times. But Parmigiano Reggiano, which was her sponsor, is not a current sponsor of Giorgio Villa.
Ooh.
They're a past sponsor. The old social media and the image you just described are resurfacing because of her star turn in the Olympics. What a good investment they made.
You know, my dream in life would be to have Parmesan wheels be my sponsor. That really wouldn't get much better than that.
Well, I actually have a suggestion for how she could get a different Parmesan to sponsor her. For fans of Arrested Development, and I am a huge fan of Arrested Development, people will remember that Lucille Bluth was always surprised by her private investigator, beautifully played by Martin Mull, who went by the name of Jean Parmesan, who used to dress up in disguises, and here's how she would always respond.
Don't get up, I just find the supplies, because I'm a private detective. Jean Parmesan, how are you doing?
Isn't he the best?
Okay, let me point out that Parmesan is a generic term that American cheesemakers like from Wisconsin can use. Parmigiano and Parmigiano Reggiano, those are trade terms that are protected by this international law. And Parmigiano Reggiano was Giorgio Villa's sponsor until 2022.
Little stuffy there, Corby Cummer. Come on. Okay, so Corby, there was a great story.
It's the greatest cheese in the world.
It is excellent. I think there's the New York Times about the impact of climate change on some of our favorite foods and some of our favorite restaurants. And they talk about the fact that they focus on California, where so much of the produce and nuts and whatever from all over the country come. The thirsty crops, as they call them, the almonds of the world, what is it, 1 gallon of water for every almond or something? Arugula is becoming totally impractical, not only environmentally dangerous, but that they have to move to drought-resistant, that's their term, products, like apparently is happening in Australia. And some of those drought-resistant products I've never heard of, rattlesnake beans, amaranth, those sort of things. This is obviously serious business. What's going on this front?
First of all, you've probably seen amaranth because even though it's a fancy name, it grows wild, including in New England. It looks like dandelion and dandelion greens. It can either be eaten as a green or, I imagine, a different variety makes a grain that's absolutely terrific. The gallon thing, this article written by an Australian environmental writer and culture critic who knows Australia. That's why he's talking, Aaron Timms by name, a lot about Australian water laws and water use laws. And the fines are so strict that restaurants have indeed began embracing drought-tolerant foods. So they say that almonds and pistachios in California require 4 feet in depth of water per acre of irrigated land. And then they say, but apricots, pears, plums, and walnuts require more than 3 feet. So we can start feeling bad about apricots, pears, plums, and walnuts. But of course, if you see these stone fruits in our local farmers' markets, don't feel bad. They're probably not irrigated. They're probably from naturally irrigated orchards. It's a delicate crop in New England, but it's a great one, and this is the month they're going to start to appear.
Okay, so this just frustrates me tremendously. Last week we talked about those strains of wheat that were preserved by and collected by and preserved by the scientist. I can remember the first name is Walter. I can't remember the last name. I know it begins with an S. And how those were being, how precious they were, and how those were being developed essentially, in some respects, to be sort of climate change-resistant strains of grain. Is there going to be no aspect of how we produce our food and whether we can produce our food that's not going to be affected by climate change?
Probably everything is going to be affected by climate change. Wine regions are changing completely. Canada is growing wine places that were way too cool to drink, to grow wine in places like Northern California, Napa, and Sonoma. They're having to change their varieties because there's so much sugar, there's so much heat that they're producing wines that are too powerful, too heavy in alcohol. But Jim, you know, you haven't heard of amaranth, but you have heard of, you will hear of peppery beans.
Nope.
And mesquite. My Food Leaders Fellowship at Aspen recently met in Tucson, and we went to a farm on a reservation, and we bought a lot of mesquite flour and peppery beans. These are incredibly drought tolerant, and U.S. and Northeastern chefs should start using them on menus so we can take Jim to enjoy them at a local restaurant.
Well, is the federal government moving toward drought resistance? Because, you know, we sort of take, a lot of guidance from the Department of Agriculture and others. Are we far behind on scaling up these foods?
No, I should credit Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack has pumped billions into what they call climate smart agriculture. It's a whole range of approaches to agriculture to reduce the number of pesticides, reduce the expense of the inputs you put in, less tillage, more preserving soil. That's regenerative agriculture, to care as much about soil as you do about the plant. So, no, U.S. policy is trying to encourage farmers to use more environmentally friendly methods. I've seen no penalties that say, Jim, if you buy another bag of pistachios and almonds, you're going to be charged double because you have a monthly allotment. You know, I haven't seen any of these rules about growing or selling water-thirsty crops.
So how come there's not a campaign with real people, though, encouraging the likes of me not to buy an almond, but to buy a rattlesnake bean? And obviously, if the demand isn't there, they're going to switch to rattlesnake beans.
Because
I'm serious, by the way.
I know.
Because the large companies with a lot of money for marketing have invested in those very popular crops that appeal to people. And Native American tribes, you know, they have limited production, and they are incredibly sustainable, but they can't afford to advertise.
By the way, before we move on to a scary topic, because I not only eat boar's head, but I also eat boar's head liverwurst. One of my favorite. Does anybody eat liverwurst here besides me? Nobody, right? Absolutely nobody.
One person, two
the whole damn audience. It's pathetic. Before we get there, oh, I think you want to post this, don't? Because it makes Jamie. Who wrote the image? Jamie and Aiden, because this is what they do. Here's an AI image of me. As I guess that's my cheese sponsorship.
That's nice.
I like that. And sort of I'm aging like the cheese, I guess you could say. In any case, thank you very much for that. Okay, so Listeria is upon us, and I don't mean to make light of it at all, because it could be deadly kind of thing. Boar's head, what is it, 7 million tons?
Yeah.
How many is this?
7 million pounds.
And
7 million
particularly
pounds, 71 products.
Okay, and one of the 71 products is liverwurst that I not only eat, but I eat by putting a hole in a tube and then squeezing, I know, which is totally disgusting. I admit that, but we're here to tell the truth. So this is huge. I mean, boar's head, by the way, for those who don't eat cold cuts, which you should not eat to begin with because they're ultra-processed, I know all that, it's really sort of the high-end, it's sort of the luxury brand of cold cuts as opposed to some of the crap, but it's still really bad for you. So what should we know about this Listeria thing and what precautions should people take and all that sort of stuff?
So if you look at the label, it has a sell-by date anywhere from July 29th to October 17th. It was processed at a plant in Jarratt, J-A-R-R-A-T-T, Virginia, where Boar's Head has paused operations. You can go online to the Boar's Head website, which has a full list of all the products, where they were manufactured, and when they were sold, where, and they'll give you a full refund. So you can go in and take it in, you just stop eating it. Listeria happens every year, and it kills something like 260 people a year. 1,600 people get sick from Listeria. Remember Blue Bell ice cream in Texas? a cheese plant in western Massachusetts that I remember. It's enormously difficult to find the bacteria. It hides, as I recall, in pipes. And so you have to completely shut down a plant, disassemble all of the ventilation, all of the water systems, and go through the pipes and clean them. It is really pernicious, and it can like completely fail and even bankrupt a company. But others, do you remember the Georgia peanut factory that was a flagrant violator of food safety rules and was
knowingly, yeah, they knew about it, and they
knew about it. This was under the Trump administration, and they were very cynical, and they shipped out products, but there was listeria in those products too. It's in many, many kinds of food products.
Yeah, I don't know if it's your area of expertise, but you mentioned, since you said it could bankrupt a company. You know, I remember when the Tylenol scare happened, it killed people, right? A bunch of people died. One of my many predictions that proved to be totally wrong is either Tylenol is going to have to go out of business or change its name, and obviously it didn't do either, and it's prospering. Does a Boar's Head, and the only reason I care is because I assume they have thousands and thousands of employees, does a Boar's Head survive? Did Bluebell, whatever the hell it was, survive?
Yeah,
do they survive?
You know, Tylenol, as I'm pretty sure, is taught in business schools.
I think it is.
People of crisis management. It was Johnson & Johnson. They immediately pulled all Tylenol on all shelves across the world. They forfeited billions of dollars to say, we take this seriously. They could afford to do it. And then they changed the packaging. They changed the labeling. So, you know, they were huge and they had the money to do it. I don't know. I don't see in this Washington Post article about Boar's Head that they've pulled all these products, they've recalled them. The USDA did immediately issue a recall, and under the Obama administration, both USDA and FDA were strengthened in their ability to actually recall products instead of telling the manufacturers, we'd really appreciate it if you would think about recalling this product. So there's more teeth and the ability to recall dangerous products now than there were.
Now, is the listeria, you said it's in the pipes, but is that dirty plant conditions, or is it, you know, in the bacteria is in the food which is moving through the pipes?
As I recall, it's airborne, and I don't know if it's bad sanitation. It's seldom blamed on poor personnel tactics. You know, it's different from contaminated meat that has to do with workers being improperly trained or cross-contamination. I don't remember reading any kind of sure, here's how listeria enters a factory. What I remember reading is it's a bear to try to get rid of it and find out where it is.
Before you go quickly, have you ever had liverwurst cross your lips in your whole life? No way.
No, I like liverwurst.
You do?
Oh, God.
I'm a big fan of liverwurst.
And
yeah.
Well, since you said that, liverwurst, Swiss cheese, Dijon mustard, red onion on rye toast. Does it get any better than that, Corby Cummer?
No, mortadella. There are a lot of Italian products that are similar to liverwurst, but there's something really fabulous about liverwurst, and you and I share that taste.
You've warmed my heart.
Everything you just said makes me want to walk over to traffic.
Kind of traffic. Corby, it's great to see you.
Don't make it Boar's Head.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate
Bye,
it. Corby Cummer.
We've been speaking with food policy analyst Corby Cummer. He's executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy.